The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and I'm very pleased to be joined this week by the writer Jeff Dyer, whose new book is Homework, a Memoir. Jeff, what made you think now was the time to write a memoir?
Well, I'm in the back of my mind, I guess I had that B.S. Johnson essay or little book called Aren't You Rather Young to Be Writing Your Memoirs? So, I'll be 67 next month, so I'd been contemplating this since... from the time that my parents died in 2011 now, incredible. I think it's a good time to do it in one's 60s, really.
And it's a story of a Gloucestershire lad.
Yeah.
So it's a slightly, not quite Shropshire lad, but...
To paraphrase Alex Ferguson on Liverpool, I thought it was time to knock Laurie Lee off his perch.
And is it the record of a happy childhood?
Yes, it is, I think. Maybe I'd generalise out from that and say less about a childhood than about a happy period in a way of British life. It's the, I'm very much a beneficiary of the post-war settlement. Yeah, it was a sort of good time in British life, I think. And then it gets worse in the 70s, but in the late 70s, of course. But yeah, it's a happy time.
You say the post-war settlement, you're, a bit younger than I am. And what's striking to me was the extent to which the war is absolutely sort of suffusing your cultural life as a boy.
Yes, it really is. I'm just repeating what you're saying now. Yeah, it is suffusing my cultural life in that... Perhaps this is one of the things that contributed to it being a happy period, because all of us kids, we had a good war. The Second World War for us, it certainly didn't involve Stalingrad. There wasn't even any Holocaust in it, really. It was just this great triumphant chapter in British life, and an adventure that was recycled in the culture in all sorts of ways, comics, films, TV series. So... there were none of the hardships of the war. There was only its cultural reproduction that we were absorbing. Having said that, it was also very present as a kind of living memory. There's a little footnote in the book about my much-loved uncle of mine, Uncle Eric, who suffered from many mental problems later in his life. And his daughter wrote to me, my cousin, saying that she thought it was the memory of the war that had had a big effect on him. And him and his two brothers, they'd all served in the war. One of them, I think, had been a prisoner of the Japanese. So it was there as a living memory too. And even my father, who had a pretty uneventful war, but...
What was his war?
He was sent to India. And as is not unusual for working class men of his generation, that was the only time he ever went abroad. And it was, in many ways, the most exciting time of his life. He was, he remained forever interested in India after that. I got to be accurate. I say it was the only time he went abroad until he was in his 70s, when my mum persuaded him to fork out the money to go on what sounded like a thoroughly wretched coach tour of northern France. So he went abroad twice.
Well, that... this is forking out money, like a major theme of the book, in some ways, is your dad's extraordinary tight-fistedness.
Yeah, of which he was... if he were alive, he certainly wouldn't sue me for that. In fact,
he took pride in it.
Really did, yeah. If we ever sort of ribbed him about it, he'd get this kind of rather satisfied kind of smirk on his face. Yeah, it wasn't anything to be embarrassed about.
How did you read that? Growing up, there's a sense of sort of feeling like they're really kind of narrow constraints in which your parents lived their lives.
Yeah.
And was that something you chafed against as a child or something you adopted and understood?
Well, like everything that happens to you as a child, whatever your parents do seems normal. So, I mean, it was just how things were. And, yeah, my dad was, even by the standards of the day, you know, is famously tight-fisted, but it was not out of keeping with a general mood, especially for someone of his generation who'd grown up in a time of real hardship in the 1930s. And I think what happened is at a certain point, that set of values, that attitude to money that he inherited, coincided or overlapped with a very different attitude as all these kind of consumer possibilities came on stream. And we took part in that, in that, you know, one of his great joys was our Vauxhall Victor, you know, which was brand new, and that was a wonderful thing. And then there's a few other things that we bought. But yeah, it was more, I mean, one of the most vivid memories I have of saying to him, you know, oh, you know, could I have this or that in a shop? And he'd say, oh, you don't want that. And I'd say, I do. And I now think that he was using that word want in the archaic sense of need. To that extent, he was right. I didn't need any of this stuff. And now as I've got older, I feel that in many ways that's so preferable to the situation now where kids consider it a human, an abuse of their human, which is exactly synonymous with consumer rights, if they're not allowed to get the very latest pair of sneakers or the latest iPhone when they've already got three pairs of perfectly good sneakers and a perfectly adequate iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, certainly you didn't obviously go through what a lot of only children go through, which is being, you know, spoilt.
Well, I did, actually. I was spoilt because on the one hand, I was growing up in this household of considerable austerity, but I was also an only child. So I was in receipt of this massive, undivided intensity of love from my parents. So, yeah, I was. I certainly was spoiled. And then my mum had this kind of wonderful understanding, misunderstanding. She'd quote that line, spare the rod and spoil the child. And she didn't realise that was a warning. She thought it was an injunction that you should spare the rod and you should spoil the child.
So did you know you didn't experience only childhood as a deficit or loneliness? You're happy as a pig in shit.
Well, I think there are many episodes I can remember where I'd be having fun with my friends out playing, and then at some point we'd all get summoned indoors. And I guess everyone else went back to their homes to have fun splashing around in the bath with their siblings or whatever they get up to, whereas I'd go home. And it's not that the fun ended, but there wasn't that kind of... I met somebody recently, which is one of 10 kids, and she was describing just the bedlam of her childhood, the chaos of it. And it was also a lot of fun, whereas the fun element really reduced a lot when I got home. So there was there was that, I don't want to exaggerate the loneliness, but it's an inherently lone sort of lone thing. And that's why, although my American editor in particular was saying that in the early sections, there's too much stuff about toys. He said, can't we move on to the human relationships? And I said, well, the thing is, if you're an only child, those toys constitute your relationship. And the picture on the cover of me, my mum and dad, the Vauxhall Victor, and this sort of blow-up creature of indefinite species. I mean, yeah, he was my friend.
That was little Jeff's friend. Yeah, I mean, the toys, there is a lot of stuff in here. And I was sort of astounded in the early sections, and forgive me, kind of unworthily, thought, as you said, well, there were these cigarette cards we collected. And then you have a sort of encyclopedic list of the specific cigarette cards and the errors and the runs and all those things. And I thought, has he just remembered collecting cigarette cards and been on Wikipedia?
Well, the interesting thing now is, of course, let's suppose I'd been writing this book 25 years ago. It would have been a bit tricky. Now, of course, any time you're unsure of things, you can summon it all up on the internet, you know, to an extraordinary degree, actually. But, yeah, my memory of that stuff is pretty thorough. And also, I did want this. I mean, I'm aware of this book sort of doubling as a sort of catalogue raisonné, you know, a full inventory of everything that I owned. But hopefully, I mean, I like inventories anyway. I mean, it's a thing for which I have a fondness. But hopefully the idea is to sort of narrativize the stock taking, as it were. And I hope I do that. And crucially, part of that narrative is the way that, so there I am as this only child, collecting all this stuff, you know, and, you know, really doing it very, very rigorously. And then in a way, just then later on in life, after, well, we're skipping ahead now, but then at some point in my mid-teens, reading sort of whooshes into that vacuum and it fulfills a similar purpose to that which was filled by all the stuff I was collecting as a kid.
Do you still have that collecting instinct, or was that a sort of feature of your childhood?
Yeah, I do, very, very much. So we just moved back to London from Los Angeles. Somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic is a container with the books that we're shipping back to a house already jammed solid with stuff. And my wife always wants to throw stuff away. I like collecting books, of course, but also I have, to an extent, inherited some of my dad's tendency to hoard things. And, I mean, there are a few moments in life happier than when you've been hanging on to something with the idea that it might come in useful, and then 10 years goes by, and then the moment comes when that thing that you've kept and that you can locate, crucially, is there. And that sentiment you've had, that might come in handy. It's a total...
It's a massive validation.
Oh, it really is. It's a wonderful
feeling.
Those
books you reviewed 20 years ago, and you suddenly remember you need to look something up in the index, and
yes,
that justifies to your wife why you haven't thrown them out.
Although I'm tending to think of things much more trivial than that. I'm thinking of some tool of some kind, which you could probably buy for, say, $2.95 in a shop, but still the thing that you've got it stashed away in some drawer is just a... There's a wonderful thing of a prophecy being fulfilled there.
The business of your dad's hoarding, I mean, you do talk about him as a person for whom, you know, respectability is kind of extraordinarily important. He's got that kind of low middle class idea of respectability. And yet at the same time, throughout his life, he's massively on the rob from his job. How does that square?
This is
La Perruque or whatever.
Well, I mean, I feel it's fair dues. They've been basically cheating him, his employer. So it's, he's just trying to get something back. So there's this moment in the book when they had really very little social life. So they would, you know, I'm aware that the Spectator summer party is coming up soon. I feel I've only just got over the hangover that I got from last year's, you know, and that's a proper party.
Yeah.
There's loads of booze, it's free. Now, it's very different. That's a party. Now, my dad's annual works party, it wasn't a party like that because the workers, they had to pay for their own drinks. So that doesn't sound like a party as you and I think of it. And there was this awful thing when he was there one day and he saw one of his bosses and says to him, "Would you like a drink?" And the boss said to him, "Oh, yes, please, Jack, I'll have a double scotch." And for days after, my dad was just telling this story like the Ancient Mariner, you know, a double, he kept saying. And it was just so awful for him. So there he was, you know, I think that's in miniature. That's an episode which, if one was Karl Marx, you might say, this is a vivid instance of how the worker is, you know, blah, 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 exploited like that.
So, yeah.
So how could he, on a daily basis, get his revenge? Well, by pilfering from the office.
Stationery companies.
Yeah, from anything, actually. A load of stuff that he didn't want. But honestly, I mean, some of the pencils that he made off with half a century ago, they're still in use in the... They've come in very handy in my particular line of work.
You might have written some of this book with them.
Well, I did, yeah.
Appropriate.
Yeah.
But that sense of some kind of... You know, you describe also, you know, they didn't go to parties, which, again, is a kind of classic trope of the era, the sort of room kept for best.
Oh, yes, yeah. The front room, yeah, that extraordinary thing. And it's funny, that front room... Perhaps because it was some sort of special room, I can remember that more powerfully than any other room in the house. And I can remember these strange expeditions I'd make in there, sort of, I was going to say a safari, but if you're on a safari, you really expect to see some sign of life, whereas there was no life in there. This was more of an archaeological expedition into this weird kind of semi-sacred space, you know.
There was a sense with both of them of a sort of preemptive disappointment, if that's the way you put it. The idea that, you know, life is like the front room is not to be accessed.
Yes, yeah. And that's part of this maybe historical transition from, let's say, the pre-war period of extreme scarcity and extreme class deference to the 1960s, where there's much more, the class differences are lessening, there's money around. And, of course, the 60s start to swing in certain parts of Britain, in London.
I mean, very small parts of Britain, aren't they? I mean, Dominic Sandbrook's whole thing is that, you know, Britain in the 60s, most people carry on exactly as they had in the 40s and 50s.
I mean, exactly, yes. Yeah. So my parents remained in the 1950s, but there was something was changing. And my sort of story becomes an embodiment of that change in a way, but still dragging this enormous ballast courtesy of my parents, of course.
What was it that started to change that story? Because obviously you become very bookish and, I mean, slightly, I think, against your well-cultivated persona of being this fantastic skiver who never really does anything properly, you obviously were extremely hard-working at school, weren't you? Or maybe just incredibly clever.
But we've skipped the crucial, you know, the absolute fulcrum or hinge of my life or on the book, which is passing the 11 plus.
Well, no, I mean, that was what I meant by being studious at school.
Yeah, but I didn't. Junior school, you don't really do any work. You just do your schoolwork. And then this day comes when you take the 11 plus. And if you believe in the test, then it's a completely meritocratic way of you know, distinguishing between the clever kids and the not so clever. But it's, I don't know, I suspect it's a thing of luck. And of course, as we always have to bear in mind, it wasn't this beneficent thing on the part of the state to give sort of working class kids a chance. Its main goal was the opposite, to make sure there was a steady flow of workers to get trades and all this, apprenticeships, all this kind of stuff. And then, a certain number would go on to the grammar school. So I was
It's a very glass half empty view of it.
So I was one of the lucky winners. Go to the local grammar school, a famously good grammar school, right up there with Manchester Grammar, you know. So from that point on, I mean, just wonderful teachers. And for the first several years, I was just sort of an indifferent student. And then, and this is such a, I tell this story only because it's so entirely not unique to me. Got started to do a bit better at school and came under the influence of a particularly inspiring teacher and started to really become interested in schoolwork. And the thing that changed it from schoolwork to something else was this thing of, you know, and again, it's classic, falling in love with reading and literature.
You've got a line in the book, which I can't quote from memory, but it's the effect of, like, everything about you, like, goes through you like a stick of rock, is being a grammar school boy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, as you say, pivot of the book. Is that something that you regard with kind of pride and gratitude or a bit of sort of ambivalence and regret?
Well, I mean, absolute gratitude, but conscious that it was all right for me. It wouldn't have been, it's not so good for the life choices of the kids who failed the 11 plus were, you know, radically limited. But for me, I mean, it's just incredible to be the beneficiary of all of this, you know, free education, a great education. And then obviously once you get to the grammar school, it's pretty likely, very few people left after O-levels, so it's pretty certain you're going to do A-levels. And from there, I mean, enormous percentage of people went on to university. And then, of course, it had a very, very strong Oxbridge tradition as well. So, you know, you are from the age of 12, you're really on your way. And, of course, you know, yeah, how could I not be A, grateful? And yes, it's absolutely just so core to my identity. And I say that now, as I say, I'm 67 next month, and I still feel that's what I am.
I mean, something that surprised me, though, in that I found myself reading this book and thinking, this chimes for me with Alan Garner. sort of a generation or generation earlier. Because Garner had very much the same experience being first in his family to 11 plus. But he's much more mournful and mystical about the, you know, illiterate working class forebears and the myth they belong to. But he does say it alienated him from his family, alienated him from the world in which he grew up.
Yes, that's, I mean, there's certainly that. I guess the cultural class thing, it's, if one thinks of that sort of Hovis advert version of working class life, well, you know, I grew up in Cheltenham, the archetypal middle class town. But there were, of course, a lot of working class people, as there are in any town. But there wasn't that really strong cultural sense, that, which I'm parodying in terms of the sort of Hovis advert. So it's not like they'd had that kind of call, but it was sort of subtler than that, really. And then there was the fact that I was an only child as well. And then what happened, I think, is that, you know, for a long time, I thought all that was happening was that I was passing exams. And my parents saw it as that, too. I mean, they, of course, like all, I mean, my passing the 11 plus was a huge thing for them that they were so proud of. And then I started coming top of the class and all this sort of stuff and got the O-levels. Then A-levels, they were happy with that. And at that point, it was sort of some other change was occurring, but it was only really after I got into Oxford, which really sort of was completely beyond their reckoning, that I became aware that there was such a big part of my life that couldn't be sort of communicated to them. And then only after Oxford, I mean, retrospectively, in my sort of mid-20s, I would say, up until then, I thought it was an entirely sort of personal experience I'd undergone. And I was aware that I was meeting a lot of, overwhelming majority of people had been to public schools at Oxford. And, you know, I was aware of their confidence and all this kind of stuff. But it's not like I was sort of bullied or made, you know, I had a great time at Oxford, but it was only subsequently, retrospectively, that I understood that what I'd undergone, that what was really going on here was a class thing. And I think in a way that's what makes the book interesting, is me as sort of in the midst of this larger social process.
When did books start to kind of come in? I mean, I'd love the detail that you were this kind of, I'm imagining this wonderful loon-panted teenage Jeff, you know, it's sort of like shaggy hair, you know, going to these dope-smelling record
that,
shops.
Do you find that rather arousing?
I do, actually. I do. I see the younger you as a very charismatic sort of figure. But, you know, hopping into these second-hand record shops and getting in love with Hawkwind and kind of coming to Mike Moorcock through Hawkwind and that sort of thing. Yeah.
So there's two things going on. I mean, the first access into books is entirely through school. And really, it starts with Shakespeare, I think, when we do Richard III for O-level. And then there's other sort of texts that we're doing. And then once I get into reading, that overlaps with sort of other stuff. And yeah, of course, there's all this prog rock going on. It's the great time of prog rock when prog really was progressive. Whereas now, of course, we're living through, in some ways, the return of prog rock. And, you know, that's an entirely regressive. It's been a regressive phenomenon for quite a long time.
Are we living through the return of prog rock?
I hear so many elements of prog in contemporary music.
Do you think that is a good thing, or do you look back on prog as kind of, get rid of those, you know, we need... did you become a punk and reject it all in a meaningful way?
I became a sort of new wave kind of thing after punk at Oxford, actually, I mean, got into punk at Oxford and then that new wave thing afterwards. But, at the time, prog rock was great. It was where it was at. And you're absolutely right that, of course, I loved Hawkwind and then became aware of Michael Moorcock via Hawkwind. And that was kind of running in parallel with my schoolwork. And there was a moment when we were studying for O-level, I think, Time and the Conways by J.B. Priestley. And I was very happy to be able to quote a line of Pete Hamill's from Van de Graaff Generator in my essay about Time and the Conways. So those two things started converging, really.
Well, there's that sort of puckish pleasure in putting disparate things together.
Yeah.
That seems to be a bricolage thing that seems to be kind of a major feature of your subsequent career, is that fair to say?
Yeah, so that would be the earliest known example of that tendency. But I think what that means is that at a certain point, you know, geography remained, I did geography and economics at A level. Those kind of things remained work, but that coming together of Prog and Michael Moorcock and with the books we were studying, English and literature, that was starting to be something which was something I just liked doing. And the borderline between work, you know, which one doesn't like to do, and stuff you do for pleasure, it really started to erode. Anyway, and from that, of course, you don't have to move very far to think of, oh, yeah, that's entirely the life I ended up leading for the next half a century.
Did your folks kind of approve of the life? You know, were they sort of astounded that, you know, you were able to make a career doing? I mean, I think you describe at one point saying, oh, I got a magazine commission to, you know, jump out of an aeroplane, or a magazine commission to do this and this. You say, I've just got this job, or I just get to do really fun stuff for free.
Well, they did like that, but when I went to Oxford, you know, and who knew what that was going to lead to? And the only thing that my dad had sort of heard of was the civil service. So he thought maybe this would be, going to Oxford would lead to that. It didn't. And there was this period of huge disappointment in their life when, after all this success of passing exams, what it led to after I left Oxford was living on the dole in a kind of slum in Brixton for about 4 years. So this was a disappointment to them, to say the least. They weren't aware that that was a completely respectable thing to do among
positively
Oxford.
Posh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what the irony is that they couldn't see that this was a proof that I'd actually sort of left the working class behind and was living the life of a proper middle class layabout. And whereas my dad took so much pride after the 2 times he was made redundant, never having claimed any benefit at all, I was just, you know, I was just keen to claim all the benefits I could. And it was a great time to be unemployed, because that safety net that had been established was still there. There was no work to be had because of for all sorts of reasons. But it was that, in that Thatcherite sort of period, it was a wonderful time to be on. Bliss was it in that dawn.
And one thing that I don't get a strong sense from the book, I'm intrigued by, is, what was your sense of what your parents' marriage was like?
Oh, well, it was a sort of a happy one, I think. It was free of all the kind of temptations that might have gone on. It was a very private one. And, it seemed perfectly happy. As they got older, they sort of bickered a lot, as happens. And it was a very, very frugal, limited one. And, yeah, towards, as they got older, my mum sort of had this idea of wanting to go on, you know, on holidays, and, you know, managed to get my dad to go on this coach trip. It was very, very limited. And then when I got married in 2000, and my wife was struck always by how sort of threadbare my parents' lives were and how they never wanted to do anything. So we'd sometimes take them to a restaurant, which my mum didn't really. She never felt comfortable in restaurants. And
your mum, we should say, was a dinner lady.
Yeah, so, that's right, yeah. So
it's a busman's holiday for her.
Yeah, I saw that joke coming as well. So, and then, you know, we got back home and we'd gone for this steak sort of dinner, and we found that my mum had sort of stashed away most of her steak and brought it back home. And then my wife kept saying, can't we do this or that with them? And they didn't want to do any of it. And eventually my wife, like me, just sort of resigned herself to their not wanting to do things. But certainly a source of regret for me that I didn't just... So they both died without ever having been on an aeroplane, for example. I mean, I remember when we went to stay in London, as we went on holiday in London when I was about 9, I think, and we got the tube out to Heathrow, not in order to fly anywhere, but just to look at the airport. Can you imagine doing that now? Well, I mean, it's the last thing you want to do, you know. Anyway, and I kind of think, oh, I wish I'd gone to Staverton Airport and booked them on a plane to have a half an hour flight around Gloucestershire, you know, just to see what it was like. I didn't do that, probably partly out of just selfishness, but also I mean, just out of a sort of acceptance of what they want, what they didn't want to do. And I then became sort of embarrassed at all my attempts to try to sort of enrich their lives. So, you know, when I discovered herb teas at, you know, at a certain point, you know, tried to get them to have that, didn't like it. If there was some music I like, I remember playing a Keith Jarrett track on the radio in the car once with my dad and said, "Did you like that?" And he said, "Oh, not really, Jeff." I mean, it was very difficult to budge them from their way of living. And I think it would have been easier to budge them if I'd had a brother or a sister to have just destabilized that notoriously stable arrangement of, you know, the triangle, the three of us.
Yeah, there is a kind of very... And I don't want to kind of give a spoiler for the end of the book, so, you know, stop me if it is. But your mum... in particular, had this, if only, you know, she had this thing, I could have been a seamstress. I wanted to do something different and I didn't. And you talk towards the end of the book about why that was. I mean, I don't know whether that's okay to talk about.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I explain that in the book. And it's, to be honest, Sam, it's something that it's so personal and private. And I really can't talk about it without two things. One, without getting upset. And also, I write about it in the book, and that's fine because writing is a private thing, even if, like me, you only write really for publication.
Whereas semi-private.
Where it's, you know, I do it privately, whereas in any kind of thing like this, we are here partly to entertain the troops. So that would, I would feel that wouldn't be appropriate for me to talk about.
Fair enough. Did you, on going back over your past... to produce this book and, you know, literally towards the end of the book, we're rummaging in the attic. did you find out things that were new? Did you find yourself going, oh, my God, I've completely misremembered that, or I've completely forgotten that, or, oh, that's why I am like I am?
Yeah, I mean, it's this classic thing with writing, isn't it, that, you know, you're trying to substantiate a scene. How do you do that with the, by sort of bringing out the details? And then what happens is that one sort of detail leads to the next sort of moment. And then all the time you're trying to bring things into the sharpest possible focus. And various sort of incidental things cropped up. But what I'm struck by is that what seemed to me the most important things, they were there and didn't require any dredging up. And also crucially, I mean, this writing in the book, it wasn't any kind of therapy. So it wasn't like there was any kind of trauma that I had to unearth or get to the bottom of. And then in a semi-Wordsworthian way, these kind of key moments in my life, not really spots of time, but they were sort of present really in a quite easy to access way. It was just a question of trying to make them as vividly presented as possible.
You say somewhere in the book, it's almost a kind of manifesto where you say, you know, the purpose of life is to avoid boredom, which seems to me to be a very good description of your intellectual way of being in the world. But it's almost like this is the opposite of your dad's attitude.
Oh, yes. I mean, my dad was, in a way, he was sort of incapable of boredom in the sense of something being, you know, we're all frustrated by boredom, whereas he just kind of had a very simple thing, really, where, you know, he just wanted to get home from work. And then when he was home, he didn't have any kind of real interests as such. I mean, he liked watching telly, he did some gardening, but yeah, he certainly didn't suffer from boredom. He had this sort of incredible sort of patience, really.
But you sort of say that, you know, gardening for him wasn't a pleasure so much as a sort of convenient task that would renew itself endlessly. And that, you know, he didn't watch football because he didn't have to watch football, but not with the pleasure of an enthusiast.
Yeah, so the gardening thing is interesting because on the one hand, they really liked gardening and they were certainly pleased by the aesthetic results of it. But nearly everything they did acquired a quality of sort of labour, really, that so many things were chores that had to be done. And that was certainly the case with the gardening, which they really, really did like. But then the huge change came. My dad was always kind of getting stuff either for free or discounted. And when he came in possession of a rotavator, you know, which meant we could speed up the gardening thing. But then equally, I mean, that really did two things. One, it emphasised the amount of work to be done, and it also imparted a kind of industrial quality to what had hitherto been a kind of Adam and Eve kind of thing in the garden. So there'd be all this sort of noise of the rotavator, and it became the garden turned into a kind of semi-rural construction site when this rotavating had to be undertaken. And then in the same way, you know, I talk about how my mum was such a good knitter. So that was lovely, and it was quite nice to sort of sit there as she would be, you know, knit one, purl one, that clack of that. And then just as my dad got a rotavator, so she got a knitting machine. So that aspect of their leisure was semi-industrialised as well as this whopping great kind of, yeah, it became a mini sort of like a cottage factory in a way. So there was always this tendency for everything to turn into to work, which is, I don't think you have to go very far to investigate why that's the case. So my mum, who was born to be a milkmaid, really, one of her sister was going to go into service. So even the things that she was, of course, like so many working class women, she was obsessed with cleaning the house. So all these things we had that were there as decorations, that became a source of work as well, because they all had to be cleaned. So she ended up sort of being in service to herself.
And, you know, it's very easy to see the ways then in which the grown-up Jeff has done the exact opposite of your parents in trying to make life into sort of from leisure and work in any, you know, famously. And I think you've got a sort of running joke in some of your books about the fact that you'll be under contract to write one book, and what's great is to get away without delivering it, or write a completely different book. That's, you know... In what ways do you think you are like your parents?
Yeah, in some of the most important ways, really. I mean, I take your point about the persona, but, you know, I was getting very anxious when you turned up when it was 29 minutes past and you got here at 20. So I'm very, very punctual. I'm incredibly reliable, incredibly honest. I pay all my debts instantly. So all of these kind of bedrock values, they're absolutely mine. And, you know, for example, I've never been able to read, well, it's not, I mean, I would never read Iris Murdoch, because I've read all about the dirt and the squalor that she and John Bailey lived in. So I remain loyal to my parents' fantastic...
Really, what, if you separate the art from the artist there, you're just
I'm not going to, you know, do you think I'm going to sully my hands reading that kind of low life, dirty stuff? No. So I'm saying nothing at all unusual here, but also the similarities between my parents and I become more pronounced to me as I get older. But the key difference, as you said, is that, you know, whereas for me, for all of us doing work that we really like, well, there's no difference at all between writing work and just living your life.
Jeff Dyer, thank you very much indeed. Homework is out now.